Wait. You know what you're doing?
Yeah. I've knocked that Adolf Hitler over 200 times.
This is Popped with Daniel, Ben, and Tanya. Join us as we discuss our favorite films, series, genres, actors, and whatever else we feel like jabbering about. Here are your hosts, Daniel, Ben, and Tanya.
Captain America was released to theaters in July of 2011 to an eventual worldwide box office reception of $370.6 million.
Captain America is sequentially the fifth film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, preceded by Iron Man, The Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2, and Thor.
However, if you were to watch according to the story timeline, you would start with Captain America: The First Avenger, which begins in the year 1943, and that is where we will begin.
You would think that a superhero movie set in World War II would have Hitler as the villain. Well,
nein!
Captain America's archenemy for this cinematic romp is the ultra-evil organization Hydra, helmed by Johann Schmidt, a.k.a. the Red Skull, played by the inimitable Hugo Weaving. I have to admit, Hydra does have a pretty catchy slogan.
Our hero was brought to life by Chris Evans. He didn't have to audition for the role, as the director and producers were keen on having him play the part. He actually declined it three times before finally accepting, and we're very happy that he did.
Hayley Atwell played the part of the literal femme fatale, Peggy Carter. Her character was capable and a skilled army officer who was often overlooked by her contemporaries for being a woman. Don't worry, though. If you watch Marvel's What If, she gets her own turn behind the shield. Hayley starred in a spin-off series called Captain Carter and appeared in several series like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., as well as other films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe up to this year's Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
Sebastian Stan, Neil McDonough, Derek Luke, and Kenneth Choi all helped to round out the ragtag gang of misfits, a.k.a. the Howling Commandos, thank you, that would be the thorn in the Red Skull's side.
The Marvel Easter eggs and the First Avenger could fill hundreds of baskets. The film abounds with fun throwbacks to earlier films and canon, as well as subtly setting the stage for things yet to come.
Speaking of which, this film featured the introduction of the first Infinity Stone. While introduced as the Tesseract, it would become an important MacGuffin in the Avengers series.
The film was followed by two successful Captain America sequels, The Winter Soldier, released in 2014, and Civil War, released in 2016.
The inclusion of the teaser during the credits, featuring Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson, is the start of one of cinema's most popular superhero teams, the Avengers.
The Avengers include the heroes Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, Hulk, Hawkeye, and Black Widow. They launched some of the biggest box office hits of all time, including Infinity War and Endgame.
Worldwide, the Marvel Cinematic Universe has brought in a combined $25,892,413,967.23. Wowzers, what a mouthful.
Well, guys, are you ready to put in our $2 and start talking about Captain America, the First Avenger?
I could do this all day. Welcome to the second episode of Season 2 of Popped. The Marvel Cinematic Universe took off in the early 2000s and hasn't lost steam yet. We're excited to review our first Marvel film and jump into this exciting in-depth franchise with what chronologically, even if not sequentially, is the first Avengers story.
Because a strong man who has known power all his life may lose respect for that power, but a weak man knows the value of strength and knows compassion.
Thanks, I think.
That you will stay who you are.
Not a perfect soldier, but a good man.
Yeah, that's a great quote. What do you think? I love that quote from the film. It's Dr. Erskine talking to our hero, Steve Rogers.
That quote itself is one of my favorite little bitty moments in the film. It describes exactly why Steve Rogers was chosen, which on the surface is obvious. But at the same time, it also describes what makes Captain America, Captain America, instead of just another thug with powers.
Yeah. Yeah, if you think about all the guys who were in that platoon with him, there were much more physically capable people who, if you imagine them getting the serum, probably would have been like super soldiers. It's just that they didn't have his qualities. You can watch it on Disney Plus. You can buy the DVD, which is what I did. You can watch it on Amazon Prime. You can watch it on YouTube, Vudu, Apple TV, and Google Play, all of those of which you're going to pay $3.99 or more to watch it. So that's how you watch Captain America: The First Avenger these days. So let's actually get into the theme. I'll tell you what I felt like the theme was, and then you guys can elaborate and give me your version of it. To me, the theme of this film is that true heroism isn't about strength. It's about character. What would you guys say?
Honestly, that's exactly it for me too. It's the main theme, not just this film, but the entire Captain America legend is all about heroism comes from the person, not from the muscles.
Right. I mean, the muscles certainly help. They help him accomplish his acts of heroism.
Yes.
But he is a hero even without the muscles.
Yep.
How about you, Tanya? What do you feel was the theme here?
I have to echo both of what you guys said. The overarching thing with Captain America is that he's not just a strong man. He's not just a super strong guy. He's got this incredible moral compass. He's got an amazing amount of empathy. And you also see sort of the flagpole scene where they're like, no one's ever gotten this flag. Like, he takes a moment. He thinks. He doesn't just react. He really sort of has like original thinking.
Yes.
And also sees, because of his good quality, he can see the quality in other people, which I think is such a huge asset, not only to him, but the people around him. You know?
From what I understand, that scene was added in rather late. It was something they wanted to demonstrate that he was not only braver than everybody else, but he actually was smarter and could problem solve. So they threw that in. I love that scene. I think it's great. He just pulls the pin and the flagpole comes down and he grabs the flag.
Yeah. It's like, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Absolutely one of my favorite moments in the film.
Yeah, so I mean, we're all agreed on the theme. It's not like it's a hidden theme. It's very much stated. It's very much in your face, which I like. You know, they didn't like piddle around with it. They didn't beat around the bush. It was, this is our theme. This is our story. Well, our story actually is about a weakling who wants to do his part to join the armed services during World War II, right? And he's trying to get into the army. How many times was it he tried to get in? He's trying to fake his way in.
It's like four or five.
Fails over and over, but he never gives up. And he finally gets in because he catches the eye of Dr. Erskine, played by Stanley Tucci. Great character.
Yes.
And it was those qualities. He saw that this kid wasn't giving up. He wanted to do his part, and he kind of wins him over. I mean, I think right there, he knows that this is the guy he wants when he sees him in the recruiting office at the World's Fair. He just knows it. This guy is who you want. How did you feel about that?
I love that little interplay between them. And I love when he asked them, so you want to kill Nazis?
I don't like bullies. I don't care where they're from.
Like, as opposed to like, I want to go and fight. You know, it was something more than that, which I thought was obviously the reason why Dr. Right. Erskine chose him.
It's like when somebody wants
to be a cop. It's another crucial part.
Sorry, it's like when somebody wants to be a cop, but not because they get to carry the gun, because they really want to, you know, do some good in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a crucial part of Steve Rogers' makeup is that he doesn't want to kill people. And that sometimes puts him at odds with the other Avengers. Not in this film, obviously, but in later films. This little bit at the first part of the film with Dr. Erskine, with the filmmakers showing us Dr. Erskine's decision process, to me, this makes Dr. Erskine himself the underappreciated hero of the entire Captain America legend. Honestly, without Dr. Erskine's unshakable determination to help people who need help rather than enhance those who are already strong, everything that Cap ever did and everything he ever affected would have been wildly different.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's almost staggering to think of what those differences would have been. And I don't think they would have been for the better.
Right.
That's true. Well, and also too, if you contrast it with Colonel Phillips, when he says,
I asked for an army and all I got was you. You are not enough.
Like his idea of a super soldier was very different than what Dr. Erskine's vision of a super soldier was.
Yeah.
So good contrast.
Yeah. And it's good that it worked out that the only one was really Steve Rogers. Of course, later on, they introduce other super soldiers into the series. But I think as far as the goals and motivation of the army at that point, it's good they only got one. And it really is the first plot point in the film. You know, the doctor completes this procedure and turns Steve into a super soldier, right? And Steve, it's a key event because Steve leaves the normal world behind at this point. And the normal world for him was pretty ugly. You know, he was getting beat up fairly regularly in back alleys and whatnot. And he always stood his ground and he always got up. And that's where the famous phrase, I can do this all day, came from, which is, it's wonderful. It tells you a lot about his character. You know, he's willing to take that beating if he feels he's standing up for the right thing. So let's talk about Steve's transformation and the effects they used to make him look so thin. I mean, it's almost seamless. I mean, do you see
it? Yeah, it was so well done. It really was.
Yeah, I've looked for it, and perhaps I just don't know enough on the technical side, but I was not able to spot how they did it.
From what I read, they filmed it from several different angles. They had to film the other actor standing on crates, you know, to be taller than he was, because he's actually taller than Bucky, right? And Peggy. So when they did the transformation, no more crates, obviously, and that was his actual physique, which is pretty amazing. I guess he did, before he came out of the chamber, he had done like a whole bunch of push-ups and all kinds of stuff to get everything pumped right before that shot. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I wish I could look like that.
I had read a piece of trivia that Hayley Atwell, actually, her reaction to him in that moment was 100% genuine, because she was shocked by like how totally ripped this guy was. She was like,
Didn't she like just like touch him? She like reached up and like touched him or something, and it's like totally. Like,
or like it was an almost touch. Like,
yeah, it's like, oh,
I
my
want
Lord.
To, but oh, I can't do that.
And also suddenly realized what she was doing and pulled herself back.
Right.
Oh my.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, they even got the oil on the body, right?
Pretty understandable.
It was a startling contrast. The transformation. I think it was so well done because you know this is going to happen. But when it does, it's so visually appealing, you know. I mean, and even him as the skinny kid was visually appealing as well. It was like, well, this is, you know, he is tiny. And they show him compared to like all these other guys waiting, you know, to be drafted. And he's trying so hard to get into the army. And he's like dwarfed by everybody. It just was, I think it was, there's so many good things about this particular film. I think it set the tone really well for all of the other Marvel films. And I think it's forgotten a lot because it sort of takes place before all the other heroes are kind of involved. But it quickly became one of my favorites. And this is kind of a thing for me, was that before this movie, I was not a Captain America fan. I did not really read his books and whatnot, because I always assumed, and this is probably my bad, was that it was just patriotic drivel. And now it's like, wow, these films turned me around on this character almost entirely. And Chris Evans' portrayal is probably one of my favorite portrayals of one of the heroes, just because it's so well done. He's so good in this role. And I can see why they didn't want to cast anybody else. How do you guys feel about that?
I agree. Well, I mean, also too, the character is so multi-layered. Like, there's a lot of depth. I think even, I mean, not that I don't love all the other heroes in this universe, I do, but I feel like the range of things that he sort of had to portray on screen was really well suited for him. Like, I mean, if anyone has ever seen Snowpiercer, like, dear God, this man has like some serious acting chops. So he was a great choice for the role.
Yeah, my thoughts mirror yours exactly, Daniel. I had not been particularly a Captain America fan at all before this movie, and not because I thought poorly of him or it, I just had not been attracted to the idea of Super Patriot.
Right.
But this movie showed me so much more than just a one-dimensional, I'm powerful because I'm patriotic kind of idea, and found out how wrong I was about what the character is. And I think more than any other hero I've ever seen in comics or movies, he's the one I found most relatable in his origin story, being the soft-spoken, geeky kid who got bullied a lot growing up. I found him immensely relatable. And then, of course, who doesn't dream of you know, overcoming the problems they experienced as children and becoming some heroically powerful other thing. And someone who hates bullies. He just resonated with me so much more than every other hero. And as you said, Tanya, I adore all the other heroes that Marvel has given us. But Cap is the one who stands out head and shoulders above the rest for me.
I will say one thing. I actually didn't mind the sort of patriotic slant of Captain America, even before I had seen any of the films. And I think part of it is just I'm really fascinated by the idea of propaganda and what that looks like. And just based on the history of the comic, like, it was so popular and it was really needed, I think, you know, by not only the establishment of the US, we're probably very happy to have something like that, but it was something for the citizens to sort of rally around in a time where there was a lot of desperation and things, you know, I mean, we were in a world war. And so that was very, like, necessary in an odd way, you know?
Well, so, they do a lot of fun takes on that whole era of the propaganda and the USO tours and him going around promoting the war bonds.
Series E defense bonds. Each one you buy is a bullet in the barrel of your best guy's gun.
It's so great. The showgirls.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, it's part of the larger story of him not being taken seriously even after he gets the serum, right? Tommy Lee Jones, commanding officer, doesn't take him seriously. And, you know, he's relegated to doing these USO tours. And I love these scenes with these dancing girls coming out. It's so reminiscent of what we actually did in this country during that time period. And you got him standing up there with his shield speaking to the audience and a Hitler actor hiding behind the showgirls.
Right. You know,
and he knocks Hitler out, you know, the fake swing and Hitler falling over. Leads to a great line later in the film when they ask him, you know,
"Wait, you know what you're doing?"
"Yeah, I've knocked that Adolf Hitler over 200 times."
Yeah, that's brilliant. The World's Fair. It's not actually the World's Fair. It's something like the World's Fair. And Howard Stark is there. And this is a tie-in to Tony Stark because this is his father. And he's demonstrating a car, which later on in one of the offshoots of this is being driven around, or at least a version of it is being driven around by Agent Coulson. And he calls it Lola. Yes. I think it's at Lola?
Yep.
Yeah. Which it's pretty cool because he's trying to get this car. He's going to have flying cars of the future, right? And then it totally fails. It was a total Elon Musk moment.
Ouch.
Yeah. You guys remember anything from this sequence here that sticks out to you?
Well, that whole sequence was really, it was just an Easter egg lovely thing, you know, because it wasn't even the exhibit. Modern Marvels?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So just everything they could do to sort of throw in little stuff, I thought that was really cool. And then we see Bucky and Steve This is where they go to I'm stuttering, holy moly, the dance with the two ladies.
Right.
And is that where he says something about like, oh, I'm just waiting for the right partner? Is that later?
Conversation with Agent Carter.
Yeah.
He says that to Peggy Carter.
Never mind.
What this did was establish his friendship with Bucky. Bucky's trying to help him meet girls, and Bucky's his like his bigger, older brother kind of thing. And I thought they did a really good job establishing these two as friends. Obviously, in the comics, it was a much different relationship. And since we're not really talking about the comics, I'm only going to just briefly touch on that. But I think as far as the film goes, I really identified with their friendship. I thought that it seemed natural and it made sense. It probably could have been explored a little bit more than it was, but in the interest of the film moving forward, they didn't immerse us in their friendship. It could be one of the very few and only flaws that I can think of in this film with regard to I wanted a little bit more. But, that's a nitpick, if anything. The Tesseract. So the MacGuffin of this film is the Tesseract, right? It's this powerful artifact that can power all kinds of things. In fact, it powers the weapons of Hydra, which is pretty cool. I like how they tied it in that way. And we know now, many years later, after all of the Marvel films, that was actually the Space Stone, one of the stones that Thanos eventually comes and gets and sticks in the gauntlet. But they get the Tesseract from... Where does this film start off at? Anybody want to jump in?
It's in...
Am I crazy? Is it Norway? I thought it was Norway, wasn't it?
It starts in Norway.
Am I crazy?
Yes, and the reason is, and you see on that the thing behind him, I'm going to call it a tapestry, but it's more of a carving or something. This is a place that was in the movie Thor, I believe. So there is a tie-in to the Thor legend as well here. And I think he even mentions it, the Keeper. What do we call him? The Harry Potter guy? The Keeper?
The Church Keeper.
The Church Keeper, yeah. He mentions the Norse mythology and the power of this Tesseract. So now you have tie-ins to Iron Man with Howard Stark. You have tie-ins to Thor with this spot in Norway, which is pretty cool. They did a really good job of throwing these Easter eggs in and really helping you follow through with where all of this stuff works together. And I'll tell you, I've watched these movies a few times through and I still catch things on rewatches that I didn't catch the first time around, which is brilliant. It makes them so rewatchable.
Yeah, they've done a fantastic job with subtle and effective tie-ins, as you say, and also foreshadowing within the films themselves.
Yeah, so Easter eggs. Where did that term come from, Easter egg? I guess because they're hidden. They're supposedly hidden and you find them?
Hidden.
Yeah.
Hidden with the intent to be found.
Aha.
Is how I would interpret that.
It's a good interpretation.
Because, presumably you want kids to find the Easter eggs. Otherwise, you've got eggs going bad all over your yard.
Yeah.
That's true.
What is that smell? Go bury your friend in the yard before he stinks up the place. Sorry, that was Throw Mama from the Train. I don't know where that came from.
Oh, man.
Random quotes. Anyway, another cool aspect of Captain America is they didn't put in a helpless damsel. We got Captain Carter, who was a fucking badass. She's chasing the guy down after the whole lab incident and, firing the gun like a pro, hitting the car.
Yeah,
she's a hell of a shot. And I love
it. Doesn't flinch with a car barreling towards her either.
I love they made her so capable and so commanding. And I mean, honestly, she would have been Captain America had she not been a woman. And that you can see it in the way that they did this. And I like that they didn't shy away from doing that, going, audiences won't like that we did this, because it that time period, that makes sense. It makes absolute sense. And I mentioned this in our intro, but Marvel, What If? I don't know if you guys have watched any of this. It's on Disney Plus.
I have not.
It's a series. It's an animated series called Marvel's What If? And the very first episode is, what if Steve Rogers didn't become Captain America and Peggy did? And it's brilliant. It's really, really good. She makes a damn good Captain America. So, well, even, but she's got the British flag on her shield, which is interesting. So if you get a chance, watch that. It's, I was thinking, what if this, I don't know if I want to see this. What's going on? You know, and I sat down and watched it, and it's nice because it's done from a multiverse perspective. And the Watcher, if you've read any Marvel comics, is this being that's beyond everything and sort of watches all of the different things play out throughout the universe and doesn't interact or interfere. But he's telling you as the narrator, in other realities, this happened. Let's see what if. So yeah, if you get a chance, it's a nice take on this particular film. This is one of the reasons I'm talking about it, where Captain Carter becomes the hero. So there you go. How about the tropes? Did you guys pick up on it? There's a lot of tropes in this film.
Yeah,
I mean, there are so many.
Indeed.
There's so many that I have like a bullet point list here that I actually cut it down to just maybe like, I don't know, 15, because there was literally hundreds of tropes in this film. I'll throw out a couple of these. You have the skinny wimp trope, obviously, right? You got the skinny character who's a wimp and he's adorkable, which is that's a trope, adorkable. And why is he adorkable? Because, I mean, well, you've got Virgin Steve, which is another trope, right? The chaste hero.
Oh, yeah.
And the action girl, Peggy Carter. But he's adorable because he can't even relate to women, doesn't know how to talk to them. She even brings that up at one point. Do you even know how to talk to a girl?
She brings it up a couple times.
Yeah, it creates some really touching moments in the storyline.
Yeah.
Where you get to learn about Steve, and he talks about kind of why he is where he is and what he's had to deal with girls. What do you think about that?
We have a lot to say, apparently.
Yeah, I'm
crickets. Well, you know, I think it sets up the great line, why haven't you learn to dance? He said, I guess I just haven't found the right partner. And it's a euphemism all the way around for his virginity, for his inability to talk to girls or, you know, find that right girl. You guys got any tropes that stuck out to you?
Yeah. Mad scientist.
Yes.
Between Dr. Erskine and Howard Stark. And I guess you could even sort of throw Red Skull in there as well. Lots of mad
Zola.
Scientists.
Going and Dr. Zola. I mean,
Zola was
mad scientist. Yeah.
Well, Schmidt, Erskine tells us that Schmidt had been a very brilliant scientist in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that he has stopped with the sciencing and gone to the mad villain taking over the world.
Right.
He just had a career change.
Yes.
He just wanted to pursue something different. He was no longer happy.
Took a couple classes at night school and found out that he should go a different direction.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely, this movie was rife with mad scientists.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
Just that, you know, not all mad scientists have to be villains.
They don't all have to be mad.
True. Sometimes they're just a bit perturbed.
The trope between Dr. Zola would be the evil counterpart. So you've got Howard Stark, and his evil counterpart is Dr. Zola. Another trope would be the I want to do my part trope, right? You got Steve who wants to do his part. Anything else stick out?
But you have the whole battle-hardened sergeant situation.
Yeah.
Really sort of like Tommy Lee Jones really does a great job of
the war vet.
That sort of grumpy...
The grizzled,
you know,
war vet.
Man,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's fantastic in that.
He is. He has the best like one-liners in the entire movie. He really does. He got gifts.
And really, I kind of feel like they wrote this character and went, Tommy Lee Jones. You know, this is him. He probably stepped in and read the script and went, oh yeah, I could do that in my sleep. That's me. He's great. I love, is there anything Tommy Lee Jones has been I haven't liked? I can't think of anything. I mean, he's in The Fugitive.
If there is, you cannot be my friend.
He's in The Fugitive. And The Fugitive is one of those films that whenever it's on, I am compelled to watch it. I don't know what it is about it. It's just, I'm compelled. There's something about people on the run and incarceration and the threat of that that makes me really drawn to like the story. I'm also that way with Shawshank Redemption. It's another film that if it's on, I will stop whatever I'm doing and sit and watch it. I got to make sure that, you know, I don't have anything important planned. If I see that, I'll sit down and keep watching. You know, it's one of those kind of films. Man, I really segued here. But the reason I segued is because Tommy Lee Jones is in The Fugitive. It's another great role where he plays this kind of gruff, grizzled character and has those great one-liners.
Yes, indeed.
A little Babylon 5 tie-in. The Fugitive features Jakar, the one-armed man. Andreas Katsalas. Yeah. So there's a throwback to another Popped episode, folks. There is method to my madness. I just fulfilled the mad podcaster trope. All right.
Yes, of course you did.
All right, let's see here. Ace Pilot. Of course Howard Stark's an ace pilot. It's a little stretch there. It's like, okay, he's the inventor, he's a pilot, he's all these things. But I guess, you know, the apple didn't fall far from the tree.
I do feel... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say, Howard Stark to me reminds me of Howard Hughes. Mm. Like, very much modeled after, like, not just a mad scientist, but he's eccentric and he's into all this stuff and proficient in different things. So
right.
He had a very Howard Hughes-y vibe.
Yeah.
Very much, yes.
There's an interesting dynamic that I don't know if you guys picked up on here with Howard Stark and Steve Rogers. Howard Stark obviously admires Steve Rogers, but Steve Rogers doesn't quite admire Howard Stark. And it has to do with the whole Peggy Carter thing, right? He's got a jealousy issue. And it was weird because, you know, did it seem out of character to you at all for Steve to be jealous like that? Or do you feel like it fit in with him? Because I know that this actually carries through into the later films, and there's a resentment that Steve has towards Tony Stark that I feel connects directly to this incident with Peggy. And he sort of resents Howard Stark later on.
I had the impression that it started even before Peggy and even before the Super Serum.
Oh, wow, really?
And it might be because of my own internal reaction to Howard Stark as he is on stage at the exhibition, introducing his car, walks on the stage and immediately kisses the pretty girl whose name I guarantee you he didn't know. Mm-hmm. And my first reaction was, okay, I don't like this guy because he's superficial, womanizing jerk who's brilliant and has contributions to make, but I don't like his personality. And perhaps that's just me, and perhaps I'm projecting that onto Steve.
Right.
But my feeling every time I've watched this movie is that is a part of the foundation of why Steve doesn't appreciate Tony Howard so much. Is because Howard's flirting with Agent Carter, not only as a rival, but also as a continuation of this pattern of he doesn't see these women as actual people so much as objects of desire.
Now, I don't know if I remember this correctly here, but you can correct me here or fill this in. There's a point where he's talking to Steve and he says he doesn't really have time for women, doesn't he? It's something about him not really being a womanizer, not being all this stuff. I think it probably is a lie, But I don't think I picked up exactly what he was trying to convey, or I feel like it was a little murky. Do you remember the scene?
I think you're right. I don't remember the exact moment. It might have been down in the...
when he gives him the shield, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was in that
R&D basement. And he's talking about how, yeah, he doesn't have or make time for women. He's exactly what you said. He's too busy doing all the stuff. I think that might have been the writer's attempt to soften the womanizing dog feel of Howard's character.
Right.
I don't know. I didn't get that vibe. Like, when I watched the movie, I was not offended by it. I don't know. Like, the time period, I think you kind of have to take that into account, because that makes a huge difference in terms of when you're you're filtering things. But even then, I mean, I feel like it was just part of his personality. And just because he's like, oh my gosh, he may appreciate beautiful women, that doesn't mean that he's an asshole to them.
Right.
There's a big difference.
I wasn't offended by it at all. I certainly didn't not like him. I see where you're coming from as well, Ben. But yeah, I think, Tanya, you're right. It's the filter of the time period of when you're looking at something. Certainly plays into it. But for me,
the
more important part was how this affected Steve and why it carried over later on to his son. You know, we got to remember that by the end of this film, Captain America's frozen, right? And he wakes up in our time period. So his memory of Howard Stark is pretty fresh.
Definitely.
And he's running into his son. And I don't know if he sees the similarities, or it'll be something interesting to explore when we get onto the later films. We can think back to this moment and try to recall this and say, okay, now this makes sense, right? And that's the hard part about watching all of these movies and trying to remember all the nuances of them. I think it's a little unfair of me to bring it up now, but I wanted to set that seed in motion, so when we do come across it later, we can look back on this and go, oh yeah, okay, remember when we spoke about that? So that's what we're doing here, folks. We're planting seeds.
So are you too? Do you... fondue?
Which is a very common thing in Marvel. And that's one of the things I love about these films. Yeah. So let's talk about the guys he rescues. So after he makes the other big, huge plot decision, right, which is to pick up the shield and go charging in after POWs.
Yes.
So here's one leap that I didn't quite care for. We're going to talk about, let's actually segue right when we talk about this. I want to segue in this little spot right here. I could have done without that. Because this isn't, I could have done without, I think it could have been done better. In the, it's Captain America montage where he's just winning, winning, winning. We had a kid who really wasn't well trained at fighting. In fact, he lost fights most of the time, but all of a sudden he is a fighting badass. Where did he get all the skills? I mean, we got a serum in him, which makes him bigger and stronger, but suddenly he can fight better than about anybody. And I found that a little bit of a stretch. You know, there needed to be, and maybe it was cut, maybe there was some more fighting basic training or something like that going on there. But this was for me, was kind of a miss. Get jumping from serum to super fighting soldier. It's one thing to get this, unless the serum gave him skills. I don't know. What do you think?
I actually never really thought about that as I was watching the film. It wasn't even something that I was like, oh, I don't believe this. I guess I suspend my disbelief pretty easily. but
I mean, do you think that's criticism?
I'm going to chalk it up to the fact that they sort of allude in the beginning that he's extremely smart, well book read, strategic. And so maybe, I mean, granted, like he wouldn't necessarily, I don't know. I'm torn, Daniel. I don't know how I feel.
I'm glad I got you. How about you, Ben?
I noticed the same thing, especially because of the physical training I've had and the fact that I've taught people many of those skills myself. I noticed it didn't bother me, but I can easily see the argument to be made that, you know, if you look at it from one standpoint, we can tell ourselves, well, the serum did all these physical things to his body, but didn't necessarily impart skills.
Right.
My suspicion is that when the writers first wrote the character of Captain America, they just decided, well, the super serum, blah, 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 and poof, there he is.
It's a magic potion.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure that somewhere on the internet there are 15 different explanations for why this is totally plausible, blah, blah, blah. For me, in the framework of watching the movie, I noticed it, but I just shrugged it off, and it didn't bother me.
Right. I'm not saying it bothered me. I'm just saying that if there was a flaw that I could pick out in this story, because there's not many, I don't find a lot of flaws in this film. This is a hit for me almost all the way around. So if I were to critique something, that would be the one thing I would pick on. So do you guys have any other moments? Now, for me, you know, I know our segment is always
could have done without that,
but I did not. Honestly, I can take it. It's just that, you know, as far as the segment goes, I feel like it could have been done better. We could have gotten a little bit better explanation of where he got all his skills. So how about Ben, do you have a
could have done without that?
Like you, I have it could have been done better. There was definitely something that needed to happen in this moment I'm going to describe. It needed to be there, but it could have been done better. And this is much later in the film, as the Valkyrie is taking off and everybody is chasing it down in one of the most gorgeous automobiles ever made. Steve makes it onto the landing gear of the plane, and Colonel Tommy Lee Jones.
Colonel Chester Phillips.
Colonel Phillips, thank you. Colonel Phillips pulls a bootlegger in the car, turns it around, and mashes the accelerator to get the tires spinning against the direction of the movement to keep the car from flying off the cliff.
Not a scratch, Doctor. Not a scratch.
That was absolutely the wrong thing to do. From a physics standpoint, if you're spinning the tires, you're getting less traction than if you let go of the tires and try to slow down the car by getting the tires to match, to not be sliding against the pavement.
You're just talking real world physics, boy.
Yeah. This is the one that stuck in my brain.
Right.
Because my brain screamed, you're going to guarantee that you're going to fly off the cliff.
Yeah. And I have to mirror you with that. But that whole segment there was a little clunky. The chasing him down in a car. The guy's in a jet, right?
He's in a super science jet.
Yeah. Yes. And they're going to chase him. Then, of course, you know, the colonel knows where this button is in a car that's not his, right? That's gonna give him turbo boost. A little far-fetched.
Yeah. Every evil genius car has a turbo boost button,
and he knew that. I guess
point of fact.
I guess he knew that even back in the 40s, you know.
so that something obviously needed to happen to help the car slow down and not fall off the edge of the cliff.
Right.
For me, that was the little thing. I was okay with Steve suddenly having skills that they didn't show us how he gained those skills. For me, it was the car not falling off the edge of the cliff.
Excellent.
I needed a slightly different explanation.
How about you, Tanya? Did you have a
could have done without that
moment?
I did. I have one, just one thing, because I thought the movie was pretty much everything it needed to be and should have been. But Hail Hydra! I'm sorry. The double-fisted, like, we are double-fisted Nazis. That makes us better. They just look like sort of like weird leather-clad spirit cheerleaders.
Yeah,
and
right.
I couldn't watch that and take them seriously and think that they were villains. Hail Hydra! Hail Hydra!
I think that's
so juvenile.
That's a great point. It's a really great point. That's another trope that actually kind of sticks out in my mind now is the faceless enemy. You know, the expendable faceless enemy.
Yeah.
You make them, you depersonalize them by covering their faces. So when they get wiped out by the other soldiers in Captain America, you don't have any connection. It's not like, oh no, these human beings were killed. Oh no, these faceless enemies were wiped out. It's like the swaths. Right. It's like the swaths of robots in the Phantom Menace. You know, Star Wars Phantom Menace.
Yeah. They're
completely pointless. Yeah. You know, they're just there to be wiped out by the heroes.
But that really sort of typifies sort of the difference between Red Skull and Captain America, because Captain America has his gang and they all have their own specific skills. They all work really well with each other and complement each other and work as a group. Right. Whereas you have Red Skull and his little Hydra army, and they are faceless to him. They are expendable to him. And that's why they lose, even though they have fucking plasma cannons, you know?
Hey, Hydra!
Yes. Actually, that's my $2, gentlemen.
Actually, I like that you mentioned that, Tanya, that ties in very closely with one of the most memorable quotes of the movie for me. This resonated so hard with me because of things that have happened in my life. But as they are still in the factory with production beginning on some unnamed or just barely named thing called the Valkyrie, and we don't know yet what it is, Dr. Zola explains to Herr Schmidt that production of the Valkyrie is proceeding on schedule. Herr Schmidt tells him to increase the output by 60%. And see to it that the other facilities all do the same, even though things are proceeding on schedule. Zola expresses worry that the prisoners do not have the strength to do that. And Schmidt's reply, and this made me think of easily 80% of the managers and CEOs I've ever worked for, then use up what strength they have left, Doctor. There are always more workers.
Yeah.
And that entire approach to even the people working for him, the people supporting his effort to take over the world, ties in exactly with what you said about how he sees his nameless, faceless throng of underlings with the, and I agree with you, Tanya, absolutely ridiculous, double fist pumping, most absurd salute I've ever seen. And that includes Monty Python, okay? It undermined the sinister effect of the faceless hordes of vast plasma cannon-wielding enemies. It's, yeah, they absolutely could have had pom-poms in their hands and it would have fit better.
Right. We've got spirit. Yes, we do. Cut off one head, we'll grow two.
Oh my God.
That should have been their thing.
I'm never going to be able to see that scene without thinking about this now.
Oh my. I really want somebody to just edit in pom poms now.
Hail Hydra.
But boy, you know, Johann Schmidt, the Red Skull, you think that guy's anti-union? Not to draw any modern day correlations, but anyway. Oh yeah, Hydra becomes a big thing in these films, and even when really? Steve goes into the future, yeah, Hydra,
I don't know, do we ever hear about them again?
Oh yeah, in Winter Soldier they pop up again. They're still around in
the country.
Are you just, yeah, I was like, wait.
Yes.
And see. Now I have no idea where I was going. It's all right.
I'm sorry.
Let's see.
I was not actually trying to do that. So it ties in with something. Hydra becomes a big thing.
They become a big thing in the films, and I like to see this beginning of Hydra, even though they got a stupid salute.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. This is not just an origin story for Captain America. It also gives us an origin story for Hydra.
Right, and the Red Skull, he touches that Infinity Stone and gets sucked up into space at the end of the film, which pays off much later in the Marvel Universe. We get to find out what actually happened to him. But it's pretty cool that this thing opens up and you see space and you realize, oh, there's a much larger universe at play here. And it's your first look into it.
It is. I have to admit, they fooled me with that scene. they reinforced it just enough with Steve telling Peggy that Red Skull died. Later on, literally years later, when I saw the Red Skull reappear in Infinity War. In Infinity War, he was talking with Thanos. In Endgame, he was talking with Hawkeye and Black Widow.
Right. Is it in Infinity War where we find out that he dropped Gamora off the edge?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's Infinity War where Red Skull shows up again there. At first, I didn't make the connection that, oh, the Infinity Stone was how he died in Captain America. So he didn't really die. What they showed us was him getting, as you just said, zapped up into space somewhere else in the cosmos. Mm-hmm. They got me hook, line, and sinker with that supposed death scene in Captain America. I thought that just simply the power of the Tesseract was too overwhelming and he disintegrated and was dead.
Right.
So I thought, so initially when I saw Infinity War, I thought it was a little cheesy, but watching the movie again, it made more sense when I looked at it from that perspective. That, oh, wait, he didn't die. He got zapped to some other place.
Yeah. And because he had taken his own super serum, he was able to withstand that stone more than a normal human would. And yes. It's interesting that he got taken into another place to be the guardian of the stone.
Of a stone, yeah.
So, pretty cool. Was it the Soul Stone he became the guardian of? Is that the one?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah, very cool. And you're right. I think when I look back at that, I also got that interpretation that he had disintegrated, right? And was sucked up into the universe or whatever. I didn't think he was going to come back. And the realization later on, I think, was one of those moments where I was like, oh, wow, that's a great tie-in. Yeah, I remember this. And it happens a lot in these films where you have that revelation, and it's so satisfying when you realize how intelligent these writers were to put these Easter eggs in and pay them off in later films.
They put a great deal of thought into this. Much more than we the audience usually see writers putting thought into the movies.
That's great. I feel like it's a good show of respect for the fans too. Mm-hmm. Like that really shows that they're just honoring not only the story but also just the love that people have for it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, before we get to the whole Captain, America being frozen and going into the future, I kind of want to go back to the lab where he gets injected and becomes Captain America, because another major thing happens there, and that's the death of Dr. Erskine. And of course, we got a trope that rears its head here, the die in my arms trope, right? Because, it's a sad moment. And in a way, this could have been on my I could have done without that list. I could have done without him dying. But this is how you make the serum not be able to be made again, right? The last vial of serum gets stolen, and that, of course, later on breaks, and so there's no serum left. So the only way they think they can replicate it is by drawing his blood and all this stuff. But you have the Dr. Erskine death, and you can kind of see it coming when they're sitting toasting the night before. But how did you guys feel about that moment and the way that whole lab scene played out with the saboteur and everything?
I'm not crying, you're crying. Shut up. The creative writer portion of my brain absolutely recognizes why it was necessary, because we had to make the super serum unavailable. And there's no way to do that as long as Dr. Erskine is alive.
Right.
But Dr. Erskine's such an adorable, sympathetic character it was absolutely crucial to the entire legend of Captain America. Mm-hmm. Everything that Captain America was began with Dr. Erskine. I was torn up. Mm-hmm. Hated the fact that he had to die.
Right.
That's
one of the sweetest characters I'd seen.
It really is a lesson. Do not be adorable and sympathetic, because you will die.
Yes, it's true.
Crap. And okay, I gotta work on becoming a real jerk now.
I think it also propelled the story, because Erskine was kind of like a father figure to Steve and then Captain America. And so now he is without anyone to really provide him with any guidance, and he has to find his own way and make his own decisions. And that sort of helps to propel the character forward, as, you know, father figure deaths often do.
His Ben Kenobi got cut down by a henchman of Darth Vader.
Or his Uncle Ben.
Yes.
If you want to relate him to another Marvel character, you'd be Peter Parker.
His Uncle Ben.
Right.
Yeah.
Depending on which universe Spider-Man you're talking about, it could be anybody. Because, you know, if anybody's seen the recent Spider-Man film, wow. So,
we'll get to that time.
Yeah. Because, you know, as much as I love Captain America, he's my second favorite hero. Spider-Man's my first.
You heathen.
Spider-Man's my first. And
heathen.
You know, you talk about
in this episode.
You talk, well, but see, you spoke about how you identified with Captain America and Steve Rogers because he makes sense to you because you feel like you share a lot of the qualities. For me, it's Peter Parker, absolutely. So, hey, Tanya, have you got a hero that you identify with and that is your favorite?
Yeah.
That's a really good question.
That's why I asked it.
No, I don't. I mean, I like all of them for different reasons. I mean, I would say just from an emotional level, I think this movie is actually my favorite of every Marvel film. And so just based on that, I guess Captain America would be my favorite hero in that universe. But
so have we all seen all of the films? I mean, obviously not including Multiverse of Madness because that just came out yesterday. Yeah, folks, this is when we recorded this.
I wasn't even aware of Multiverse of Madness.
It's the new Doctor Strange film that was just released yesterday.
Ah, okay. I am out of the loop on that.
Was it yesterday? Maybe day before yesterday. I don't know. I seem to have lost some time here.
So but yeah, all the movies in the MCU arc, I've seen them.
Yeah, even the Eternals and all those. And everybody's seen the new Spider-Man film?
I have not.
Yes.
It's called Spider-Man No Way Home. Yeah, and it brings back Doctor Strange, which is great because then you got the new Doctor Strange film, which I'm planning on seeing tomorrow. So I'm super excited.
Nice.
Super excited.
I'll probably be watching it pretty soon with my brother.
Steve Rogers, Captain America, has this big battle with the Red Skull aboard that plane. What'd you call it, Ben? What's the plane called?
The Valkyrie.
He has the battle aboard the Valkyrie. I should know because Flight of the Valkyries is a very German sort of, you know.
Yeah.
But they don't play that music. Anyway, so he fights Red Skull on this Valkyrie, and the Tesseract essentially destroys the flight systems, and it's going down after Johan goes up. And
yes, there must be balance.
Captain America, you know, one thing I didn't bring up was the unrequited love trope between him and Peggy. And it's really sweet. I love their interplay.
I don't think it was unrequited, though. It was unresolved. Yeah. They both were fully into each other, and had the timing worked,
but
they fully would have.
They were fully into each other, but they didn't. They never really truly connected until the end, and then he's gone, which leads to unrequited love.
Yeah, well, because they thought they had time.
They thought they had time, but they didn't. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a life theme there. You think you have time, and you don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's going down in these last moments, you know, they're making a date. And it's truly, to me, this is what got me. This is what choked me up when watching this, was because I really love the interplay of these two characters and think that they're just great together. This is another very well-written part of this story that is very touching. So when the plane's going down and, you know, they're making these plans, it's heart-wrenching, right? And you see her talking to him, talking about meeting her in this place, and then static, right? And it's like, oh, I remember the first time I watched this, I was like, wait, what? he's got to be alive. He's got to be alive, you know? And, you know, he's not. He's frozen. Of course, you know, you don't really find this out until you get to the credits and whatnot, but the ending of the film. Sorry, it is the ending of the film. He wakes up in a hospital and they've got that game playing. I thought this was another brilliant touch. They have the baseball game on, and that's what actually clues him into the fact that something's not right, because he was at that game.
Right. Yeah.
Which is another demonstration to us, the audience, of exactly how smart Steve really is.
Mm-hmm.
He's woken up from a 70-year coma, and his brain is facile enough to realize, okay, I was just at war in 1943, 44, whatever it was, but this is a game I was at in 1941.
Yeah.
And he gets that from listening to the radio announcements of about 3 or 4 baseball plays.
Yeah, that's great attention to minutia on his part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the nurse comes in, and of course, he freaks out and runs out, and he's in this facility and everything's fake. It's all a facade. And he runs out into Times Square, and it's so well done. Him spinning around and seeing all of this stuff. And can you imagine how overwhelming that would be for somebody from 1943 to pop up in modern day Times Square and see all of that? And
yeah, it would be overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely. To me, this sequence was, I don't know if it's the best sequence in the film, but it sure as hell to me is one of the better sequences. I loved how they played this out. And I mean, I remember watching it and going, wow, okay, this is how they do it. This is how he's here today, and he's going to be in all these other films now.
Yes.
How did you guys feel about that whole transition and that what they did there, bringing him into the modern time?
I thought it worked absolutely seamlessly. I thought it was a brilliant and exceptionally well done way to bring him forward into the future, into his future, our present.
Right.
Yeah. I had, not only did I have no objection, I didn't see anything that I would have, anything at all that I would have changed about that. Nothing.
Yeah, same. And then it makes you excited too for like what's coming, because you know it's just going to be amazing. So that's, you know, it just builds that anticipation.
Yeah.
I love how he's standing there, you know, completely just dumbstruck by everything. And Nick Fury comes up and...
You gonna be okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I just... I had a date.
That's what is on his mind.
Yep.
That's what he cares about.
Yeah.
And it's so touching. You, I mean, that you realize, holy crap, 70-year coma, 70 years. You know, he finally connects with her, and 70 years has gone by. It's really gut-wrenching. Like, I mean, our hero's alive. He made it. But the sacrifice in this film is so great. He's making sacrifices all the time, and this is probably the biggest of them all. So...
Yep.
It, to me, the fact that it wasn't necessarily a happy ending, even though it's not necessarily a sad ending, it's more of a tragic ending, I found that much more compelling than a lot of films where they try to put a nice little bow on the end and make you feel good.
Okay, so my favorite moment in the entire film is when Captain America and Red Skull are in the factory and the bridges pull apart, and they're both like, just that visual of the two of them separated and looking at each other. And then Schmidt pulls off his human face and discards it, like throwing off the vestiges of his humanity to be, you know, fully embrace this, his villain self.
Mr. Edgerton.
God, I have goosebumps. Just that moment for me was so awesome. It was so well done.
Yeah, anyway, Hugo Weaving.
I couldn't let this recording go by without that.
No, I'm glad you did, because Hugo Weaving was exceptional in this role.
Yes.
It just really brought, God, he's a great actor. And that was a great scene. I'm glad you brought that up, because it visually it's stunning, you know, and it creates so much dialogue without actual words, right? The bridge pulling apart, there's so much symbolism in that. We're really apart on where we stand on these issues, you know? And I love that. I absolutely love that. Ben, did you have a favorite moment in this film?
It's hard for me to choose one favorite moment. There are so many moments in this film that I absolutely adore. Similar to Tanya, I think she said this is her favorite of all the MCU films. This movie, along with Hook, this is a fun coincidence for me. Our first two episodes are my top two favorite movies of all time.
Oh, wow.
There are almost no other movies anywhere that measure up for me to Captain America, the First Avenger. One of the standout moments for me does not even involve Steve. It actually involves a secondary, almost tertiary character, Dum-Dum Dugan. This scene with Dum-Dum Dugan as the members of the 107, and that's something I want to come back to actually a little bit later. As the members of the 107 are being placed into prison cells in the fortress, I think it's in the Swiss Alps. Mm-hmm. While placing Dugan into a prison cell, a Hydra guard spitefully knocks Dugan's hat off his head with I'm going to call it a Wilhelm club. Mm-hmm. If you're in London or the United States, we might call it a billy club. Dugan turns to the guard, gives a slight grin, and he says,
"One of these days, I'm going to have a stick of my own."
And it's a brief little thing. It's humorous. It's almost a throwaway. But for me, even from the first time I saw it, this is a powerful display of maintaining a positive mindset in the midst of desperate circumstance.
Yeah.
And that is it's a reinforcement of one of the main themes, one of the main characteristics of Captain America and the entire legend of him. Mm-hmm. is being able to maintain the mindset of can do, therefore must do.
Right.
Or sorry, reverse that. Must do, therefore can do. Keeping the mindset that, yeah, things suck right now, but there's going to come a day I'm going to get this done. That's an incredibly affirming idea for people to hold in mind. Hmm. And I thought it was very powerful, especially for such a moment that other people might just consider a throwaway.
I agree with you. That is a wonderful moment in the film. And I remember it very, very well. I like the token Irish character that, you know, drops those lines. And
yeah,
he's a great addition. Obviously, we're going to talk about him when we get to our next segment. My favorite moment in the film, and I say my favorite, it's actually only because of how it affected me emotionally when I first watched the film, is the quote-unquote death of Bucky. And because I wasn't expecting it, I should have been, but you know, I didn't read the comics. I didn't know if you know how this was going to play out. That fall off of the train bridge.
Off the train.
Just was, yeah. I was watching that thinking, well, no, wait, no, he's losing everybody, right? And that was the first big one right there was Bucky. The reason that it's probably my favorite film was just because how much it hit me, you know? And it was so well done. I loved he's trying to reach out. You know, here's this hero who can save everybody, who has all the strength, and he can't save his best friend. And I think that added another nuance, another layer to Captain America to make you care about him even more. And I love moments like that in movies where they help you, and it's not shoving it down your throat or force feeding you to make you feel this way. It was a genuine way to bring you closer to the character of Steve Rogers and Captain America. So that's my favorite moment. All right.
Very nice.
Ben brought up something that made me realize we have another segment that we have to get to.
I know that, dude.
Yes.
Yeah, we have an actor that we're going to talk about from this film that we actually, this time, instead of me just saying, hey, we're going to talk about this actor, I threw it out there to you guys. Like, who do you want to talk about from this film? And you guys picked a really good one here. We're going to talk about Neil McDonough. Yes. Tanya, do you want to start us off with some things about Neil McDonough?
Absolutely. So he is I mean, if you ever had to call an actor ubiquitous, it would be this guy. He's been in a lot of major films and series, but he's also done a lot of guesting, like one off guest, you know, on just like a one episode of a series. Like he's been in the X-Files, he's been in CSI, American Horror Story. So you may, and he's got such a distinctive look to him that once you see him, he doesn't really leave your brain because most, you know, he's just got that coloring and he just has very specific features. And he's one of those people that whenever I see him in anything, I'm always like, where in the hell do I know this guy from?
Right.
And it's always there. But yeah, he's a just ubiquitous and awesome actor.
I mean, he is an Irish descendant. His grew up in Massachusetts and his family emigrated from Ireland. And his mother was from County Tipperary, and his father was from County Galway, which is where my great-grandfather's from. So I share that with Neil McDonald.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Anyway, yes. Ben, what's your history with Neil McDonough? Where do you recall him from?
Neil McDonough. I know that the first place I ever saw him, he played Lieutenant Buck Compton in the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers. Mm-hmm. So playing Dum Dum Dugan was not necessarily his first foray into playing a character from World War II. I also remember him as Damian Dark from the DC Comics TV series Arrow. So I think it's kind of fun to think he's played characters for both DC and Marvel. My very favorite thing that I've seen him in, however, and the reason that I'm always absolutely delighted to see him again, is the miniseries Tin Man, which was an absolutely delightful reimagining of L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. It was very steampunky without trying to go maddeningly into all the steampunk tropes. But it's a very interesting take and shift on the characters and what happened to both the events that we usually think of in the movie. It's an alternate Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Absolutely loved it, and I loved his character in it. He plays the title character. For now, I don't want to spoil anything for either you or other people about this series, but it's one of my favorite little things that I've seen in television.
Make a mental note, Ben. Make a mental note when I ask, you know, yes, what series you want to go over next season. You might want to throw that in there.
Oh, I've already made that note. Yes.
Tanya, what is your history with Neil McDonough? What do you remember him from or recall him from?
So I was going through his filmography and I remember now why I recognize him, and I've always recognized him from an early, early age, is he was in the movie Ravenous. I don't know if either of you have seen it, but I think Robert Carlyle was in it. Yeah, and I saw it in the theater because it was just super cool and an odd film that I really wanted to see. But ever since then, I've been like, oh my God, it's the guy, I've seen him in something, and it was Ravenous. But he's also been in Minority Report. He looks like Minority Report. Mm-hmm. Like, he's very Samantha Morton-esque. But you know what I mean? Like, he's kind of just based on looks, he's like the perfect cast. Right. In that movie. I'm rambling now, sorry.
Not at all. Yeah. That's where I remembered him from, was Minority Report. And it took me a minute to connect that, because I see his face in things and I'm like, I know this guy, I remember him. And I remember liking him. He was, I think, Officer Fletcher in Minority Report, which is some of us love that film, some of us don't. But I really enjoyed Minority Report, and he's been in a bunch of other things that I've seen, but I don't specifically remember him in those films and series, which to me tells me that he's somewhat of a chameleon as well. For such a guy that stands out so much and has such a unique look, it's interesting that he gets away with being a chameleon. So I think that's rather impressive. But I mean, yeah, I'm looking at his filmography as well. He started acting, or at least in film, in 1990. He was in Darkman. He was just a dock worker, but that's where he started. And he's got everything Star Trek: First Contact, Fire Down Below, Ravenous, Minority Report, Flags of Our Fathers. He's been in so much stuff, The Hitcher. And I just like when you come across a person like this who's been in all these things and sticks out in your head so much. I'm looking at his television credits: China Beach, Quantum Leap, Babe Ruth, Blue River Jag, Iron Man, Murphy Brown, NYPD Blue, The Incredible Hulk. This guy's been in lots of things. It's amazing how his resume is amazing. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He was in Agent Carter, Arrow, The Flash, you mentioned, Legends of Tomorrow, Yellowstone, Altered Carbon. I mean, it's impressive. He also has done some video game voicing, which is cool. Yeah. Anything else you guys want to add about Neil McDonough, or have we kind of covered the gamut on this guy?
I did find a couple actors who showed up in the movie who I think are worthy of at least an honorable mention within the "Hey, I know you."
Fair enough.
I know that, dude.
I'm going to say I can put it out as a little bit of a quiz. Can anyone think of two actors from this movie who were also in the Harry Potter movies? And the first one hit me as I was rewatching. This time, it took me until this watch through to recognize very close to the beginning of the movie when Johann Schmidt actually goes and breaks into that church in Norway. Did we say this?
Norway, yeah.
To gain hold of the Tesseract in the first place, I recognized a very particular version of grumpiness. And in the scene, I was thinking, wait, that grump, I recognize that grump, but where do I know it from? And it hit me when I heard the voice and saw the face together. The church keeper himself, the actor David Bradley, was also Argus Filch in the Harry Potter films.
Okay.
The eternally, awesome. The eternally grumpy hall monitor, I guess he is. I'm not sure. I don't remember what else his role was. He was pretty much there to just make sure kids were miserable and not having any fun.
I was worried there was going to be another Professor McGonagall appearance here. Since we had one in Hook, right? Like, uh-oh, Ben's got another McGonagall thing.
Well, now hold on. There's another actor here who showed up in this movie.
Is it?
No, it's not Professor McGonagall.
All right.
However, Dr. Arnim Zola.
Yes. Yeah.
Schmidt's Geek Squad mad scientist doctor. The actor is Toby Jones, who was also Dobby the House Elf.
What?
In the Harry Potter films. He was the voice talent
for
Dobby.
He looks so different in the films.
You're right. He does. His eyes are a little bit the same. The ears are definitely different.
Wow, okay. And I did not know that.
Master has given Dobby a sock. Master has presented Dobby with clothes. Dobby is free.
Yeah. I surprised the heck out of me. And really, I went and looked for it. I wouldn't have known that Toby Jones was Dobby, except that after identifying Argus Filch, I had the thought, well, gee, wouldn't it be hilarious if there was another cast alum from Harry Potter who had also been part of this movie too? And well, the universe had a good laugh at me because, yes, indeed, there was another one, it turned out.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
That's great. I will say, just quick side note, David Bradley is amazing. If anyone who's listening, or even you guys too, if you haven't seen the TV series The Strain, he has one of the main roles in the show. I believe it's Abraham Satrakian. And it's a vampire show, but sort of turned on its head. It's super, super good and really well acted and well written. But he was so amazing in that series. I highly recommend it. It was really good. But yes, he's fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah, absolutely. The Strain. I just thought that was something people did on Sace.io.
Yikes.
On that note.
All right.
Let's get to popping. We're going to give our rating, which we do in pops, for what we thought of Captain America, the First Avenger. And Ben, I think I already know what yours is, but why don't you hit us with your pops?
I think it will come as a ferocious surprise to absolutely no one anywhere that this being one of my top two all-time favorite movies, this gets five pops for me. I love everything from the story to the characters to the acting to the cinematography. There's nothing I don't like. There's nothing I don't love about this movie. Possible exception of the car not falling off the cliff. The car, however, oh my gosh, I want that car.
Yeah. Tanya, how many pops do you give Captain America the First Avenger?
For me, it gets 4.5 pops. It is not five. And the reason why, gentlemen, is just because I think of movies that I would totally give five pops to. Like movies that I'm like, oh my God. And I don't have that same emotional connection with this movie as I do with my five pop movies.
Heresy. You're dead to me.
Heresy.
I'm sorry. 4.5 pops is still quite respectable, guys.
Totally kidding. Please don't worry.
Yes. But I loved it. I thought it was great. Like I said, my favorite Marvel film. Nothing about it felt forced. Nothing about it felt like it didn't belong or didn't propel the story forward in a meaningful way, except for the double-fisted Nazi Hydra salute people. But that's it. Maybe it lost a half a pop for that. I don't know. That could be.
Man, that's a harsh way to lose half a pop.
4.5.
Pom-poms. Pom-poms, fellas. Pom-poms. For me, this film is an easy five pops. And the reason it is because not only did it turn me around on a character that I had prejudged, I find it to be fairly perfect in almost every way. I love what they did with this film. I love the emotional roller coaster ride it takes you on. I love the theme and the message about strength being character instead of muscles and, you know, brawn and guns and bullets and whatnot. It doesn't miss pretty much anywhere for me. And even the one criticism I had was a very minor quibble. This is one of the best Marvel films. It's not my favorite Marvel film, but it is definitely in my top three. So there we go. Five pops from me.
Ready on.
Very good. Sorry, I ruined our unanimity.
No worries. I was actually fairly certain by the way this thing went that we were all going to be five pops for the first time. So, yeah, Tanya, you ruined it.
Sorry, I was trying to be very discerning. I mean, I can't give every movie five pops.
No, you can't.
I mean, certainly I could. Not a problem. But
have you given one five pops yet?
I think I gave a Sherlock Holmes one five pops, didn't I?
Yeah, the Hound of the Baskervilles. Maybe that's the one you gave five pops.
I think so.
Yeah, this is a damn good movie. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Good movie.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. Any final thoughts on this before we have Tanya tell him stuff? Yeah, Tanya. Tanya, it's going to be you.
I'm telling him stuff.
I do have one other thought. I had a funny non sequitur moment in the movie, and had this the first time, every time I've watched the movie, and also this last time as well. There's a part where, let's see, when Cap is riding his motorcycle through the forest on his way to Schmidt's base in the Swiss Alps. Okay, he's heading to rescue. Oh, right. I also wanted to come back to the 107th to rescue the platoon that got taken captive. An entire platoon size force of motorcycle goons converges to chase him through the woods. And I immediately was transported to Return of the Jedi. Onto the forest moon of Endor.
Right. And
yes! I had that total same vibe when I watched that.
I was sitting there watching Captain America, but seeing Luke and Leia on speeder bikes battling it out with the scout troopers. And thought to myself, where are the Ewoks?
oh no. Not the Ewoks again.
It did not diminish my enjoyment of the movie, my absolute love for the movie. That one scene might have been a teeny bit cheesy, but it totally worked in the framework of not only superhero movies, but also specifically superhero comics that were developed during that were written during World War II. It was simply memories of something else that was super similar within myself that I brought into that. So I had that funny moment. Something else that I noticed this one time that I had not quite pieced together any other time that I watched the movie was that unit that he rescued, that Steve rescued. Yes, it was Bucky's unit. But they also did reveal to us earlier in the film in two separated pieces, so it wasn't obvious. The writers really didn't smack us in the face with hardly anything in this movie. But that unit was also the unit Steve wanted to join because his dad was in that unit.
Oh.
So yeah. It was extra. It was not just extra meaningful because of Bucky. It was also extra, extra meaningful because that's the unit his dad was in.
Nice there
was
attention no way to in the detail world there, Ben.
No way in the world he was not going to go after them.
Right. And it's something that we didn't mention when we were talking earlier. I just brought up that he was going after POWs, but it is a huge plot point that he decided to do that because Bucky was in that unit. So
yeah.
That's another level or element that I hadn't even considered.
Yeah, that's very cool. Oh, and then speaking of your Star Wars thing, reminded me of the little homage to Raiders of the Lost Ark when Johann Schmidt says, "Oh, and the Fuhrer is digging for trinkets in the desert." Like, yes, that was like
that was
just
great.
A lovely little nod, which I thought was really cool.
Speaking of Ewok, that was brought up in the last episode. Tanya said that the Lost Boys area in Neverland.
You're right. Reminded her it looks like an Ewok village.
Right. So,
are we being haunted by the Ewoks?
Oh my gosh! I just want you to be like an Ewok themed prompt season.
Tanya, I think we've gone long enough here. Why don't you tell them stuff?
Check us out on poppedpodcast.com, where you can learn about us, listen to episodes, join our Patreon, and support this podcast, the one you're listening to right now. Send us an email or like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Go to Apple Podcasts, Audible, or Spotify, or also Amazon to listen to us. But you can leave us a rating and, if possible, a review. The more you rate, the more likely we are to be listened to. So we would really appreciate that.
Yes, yes.
Also, leave a comment about our episode. What did we get right? What did we get wrong? We would love to hear your opinions, your feedback.
We would.
Most definitely. And then any requests you might have for future popped episodes.
Yeah, feel free to engage us on the socials, Facebook and Instagram. We do have a Twitter. I don't use it very much, but... you can engage us on there as well. Next time on Popped, we're going to do a bonus episode, breaking with the tradition of top five films. We're going to talk about our bottom five films, the films we absolutely hate. I hope you're ready for that. And I surprised my co-host with this right now because, I meant to talk to you about it before. But I wanted the genuine reaction there.
Oh my god, that's gonna be hard. I'm gonna have to start thinking.
I won't. I know brain, I know pretty much what I don't like. It'd be pretty easy. So anyway,
I hope I just will say one thing that I hope is that when we get there, that things that are on your list are not things that I really like, because that would be terrible.
Everybody's got different things they love and hate. In fact, I found out that Ben absolutely does not like a film that I love. And I'm okay with that. It's okay not to like something somebody else is into. Minority Report. Anyway.
I've actually been thinking about it more since we had that conversation, and realizing that when I saw Minority Report, I had some stuff going on in my life that may have strongly colored my reception of that movie.
Fair enough.
So I will need to watch it again to reassess.
Oh, and I just wanted to give you one little tidbit here, Ben. just to get your gears going. You don't like time travel films, right? They're not like your thing.
Generally not my thing. In fact, my dislike list will probably be heavily laced with them.
Gotcha. Well, I want you to know that one of your top two films is a time travel film. This one.
Mind blown.
I'm crushing your head. Crush.
Captain America travels through time.
You bastard.
In a coma, oh, but he travels through time.
Yes.
You're welcome.
The time travel movies I dislike are where they take time travel and use it as an excuse to really break all the rules and just basically fuck with the audience.
Oh, I totally understand. It's just, I thought it'd be fun to, you know, hit you with
absolutely
that.
Was fun. It was absolutely fun and totally appropriate, and you bastard.
All right, you guys. Well, that was what we had for today. Let's move on to our next segment, which is a celebrity interview with I don't know who. Maybe, I don't know, or a sound table. Are we gonna do a sound table? Fuck if I know. Do we even have another segment? Do we even have another segment for this fucking show? Yeah. What was the rendition?
Oh my god, Jakar just poked out from behind your background. Jakar, it was like the creepiest thing I've ever seen.
Jakar is everywhere. Hey, make him appear.
So is Jakar going to be our celebrity?
You just listened to Popped. Like us on social media or visit our website, www.poppedpodcast.com, where you can listen to episodes, comment, send us emails, or support us on Patreon. Thank you, and see you next time.
Hail Hydra!
Great to see you guys.
Hail Hydra!
Hail Hydra!